accession number 19943, reel 5.
Professor Pashkevich, reel 5.
Well, I was trying to argue and I've explained to him. Well, look, don't be offended. I don't like, it's very, my memories, camp memories are very important to me. After all, you see, my brother died there. But I'm a historian by profession. And you see, I don't like people who are spreading false information. And you see, information about Auschwitz, that it was purely Jewish camp, but it's simply not true. Yes, he said, I know it's not true. I know I'm historian as well. You see, why you try even to convince me? I am trying to tell you that you don't know who this gentleman was for us, for Jewish society. I said, well, you see, I'm not interested. I am not even asking you who he was. He simply should be more sensible, and if he was talking about the subject, he probably he should ask me the question, what I think about it, and not try to, in a rather arrogant way, to force his own point of view on me. Yes, and Edgar said, well, yes, you see. He said something very surprising to me. He said, well, look, I know you would not understand why I did not intervene. I said, well, why? Tell me. I tell you why. Because for 2,000 years we were persecuted. And you were not. I said, well, we were persecuted for 200 years. That's not long enough. You don't develop the national psychology for during 200 years. And he convinced me. I would see the reason why all those misunderstandings about the camps and things of that kind. You know, it was this well-known fact that in Auschwitz, those Catholic nuns received the sort of place was given to them next to the camp, not inside the camp. And it was a very strong Jewish protest that the cross was standing in front of the nuns' convent was offending the, well, millions who die here. True enough, but those millions die a mile and a half away in another camp, not near the place when, but one way or another. I think the symbols are very important. I know the symbols are important, but you see, you have to be tolerant after all. You may even swastika is not a symbol which would offend me today. If you would put the swastika here on this table, I would not start to spit on it or throwing it through the window. But I think, I do realize that there may be some people, they probably were Germans, some Germans, who truly believe in this ideology. To me, it's very difficult to believe that it can happen, but it did happen. And I think tolerance do help, and it's probably not enough of it.
So this, I was asking you about the extent to which you mixed with Jews in the camps, and you were saying, I think, that the Poles and the Jews weren't mixing together very much.
Simply because they didn't have no chance. They were kept separately. I mean, in Auschwitz. Because, you see...
And also in Mauthausen.
Not necessarily, because in Mauthausen, towards the end of the war, but only towards the end, during the last probably 8 months or so, Germans radically changed their policy. You see, they needed factories. And they needed factories operating well. So, for instance, in our factory in Steyrwerke, we receive transport of Jewish prisoners, somewhere from either France or Belgium or something like that, and they were working together with us. I definitely they were not living on the same barrack than I was. But that's not surprising. I don't think that they were kept separately. I think they were living only in other. This I don't know, that I'm not sure about it. But in work, they were treated exactly the same. They would receive the same food and things of that kind at that time. The only difference was that they used this yellow star. So at that time, I was working. But that was just very much the end of the war, last month, so to speak.
But in Auschwitz, when you were there, which was, I think, 1941, approximately.
Yeah, and beginning of the first half of the 42.
The Poles were in Auschwitz and the Jews were in Birkenau, which was being built.
Exactly. That means that the Jews, I think, started arriving rather late during the period when I was in the camp. And as I said, if by accident or if by some happening would be Jews in the transport, like they were those 81 or 83 of them in my transport, they would be killed. That's true. That's absolutely true. But they were rather exceptions than the rule.
And what about these other categories in the camps, like gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, and homosexuals?
Well,
did you come across those?
Yes. Gypsies were treated more or less like Jewish people. In other words, it was the clear tendency to kill them. Jehovah's Witnesses, I would say, if anything, they were probably slightly privileged group. All those religious groups, they were prisoners. They were treated badly in a way, but either they managed to organize themselves, which is quite likely, you know, being a sort of solidarity between them. If some of them had a better job, he would push his own friends to it. Because I remember, you recognize them by color of the triangle. It was a violet one. And you would nearly, as a rule, would find out that they would have better jobs. Not better in this sense. They would be not in the administration. But they would be, say, for instance, shoemakers or carpenters, people like that.
And you personally came across gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, and homosexuals?
Well, yes, but not that I would have friends, I mean very close friends, between them. So I couldn't really tell you much from inside, so to speak. As far as gypsies are concerned, probably he was actually a young friend of mine. He was for quite a long time, not quite a long, probably for 2 months, together with gypsies in Birkenau in the quarantine. So he would tell you more about gypsies. Because I guess that they were all killed eventually.
And what about this question of experimenting on people? Did you have any personal knowledge of that?
Not strictly personal. I was very near to it in the hospital in Auschwitz. I was twice in hospital, once in Auschwitz, one in Mauthausen, Gusen. But in Auschwitz, I was on the block, on the barrack. They call it Bahnhof. Bahnhof means station, railway station. But that was the place when they were killing people by giving them injections of petrol or phenol or I think some. Simply because at that time, gas chambers did not exist. Well, it was a one. No, it was no gas chamber in Old Auschwitz. It was only crematorium in Old Auschwitz. So they were killing people by giving them injection. It's a very not very efficient way of killing people, you see. And that was performed by the German doctor, prisoner, who was giving those injections. And I was on this barrack. People were queuing, usually very ill people. They were queuing, going inside and not returning. And later on, I met somebody who I became a very good friend of his, who was actually working there as an assistant to the doctor. Doctor was giving injections. His duty was only preparing doses and so on. He was kicked out of it because he was not very efficient. He was a student of medicine, Polish student of medicine, you see, during his life before his arrest or before the war, and he. Surprisingly, you know what was the reason? One day, this doctor who was killing people by hundreds, came in and looked on the instrument, and the instrument was metal instrument to give injections was rather rusty, and he said, "How you, being a man who have ambition to become a doctor, would really treat the instrument, medical instrument, with such a disregard?" And they kicked him out, and he was sent first to the stone quarries, and then eventually he landed in the same factory in which I was. But you see, answering your question, I was not personally witnessing experiments, but more or less I was experimenting these deadly poison injections. Well, very near to it. I mean, only the door behind, next to my bed was a door, and people were entering. Actually, as far as I remember, I never remember any shouting at all. Probably, in a sense, it's not a very painful death. Injection is probably working very fast. It's an inhuman way of killing, of disposing of people, but it's not, strictly speaking, very painful one. Probably the same can be said about gas chambers. It's psychological cruelty, but I suppose if you give a reasonably good amount of the gas, well, it would act very fast. Not that I would recommend the way of getting rid of people like that, but surely not. But I think, you see, dying in the camp, I think the worst form of dying in the camp, majority of people would die like that, was the, if you are weak, undernourished, and you collapse during your working hours. They would most definitely kill you. And that would be usually very painful death.
How would they kill you?
Well, they would probably jump on you. They would beat you literally to the death. And if in stone quarries, they would actually throw the stone on you and break your skull and so on, things of that kind. So in other words, that's very likely the worst fate in the camp, not the mass murder. Mass murder, morally, is of course much more to be condemned about it, because you are working in great numbers. But as an individual suffering, it's other way around somehow.
And this question that's recently come up in the British courts with a recent court case in which the question of gassing or mass extermination by gassing has come up. Would you like to say anything about that?
Well, I think that if I would judge morally the awfulness of it, it's the fact that you are applying the almost mechanical method to destroying your enemies, not really enemies. I mean, you see, awfulness of the fact of the mass murder of people in the camps was the fact that they were not individually your enemies. It's nothing to, I mean, probably they were innocent women and children, and even if they were men, they were not actively involved in fighting Nazism. So the fact of colossalness of the problem, it's morally revolting. The method itself may be, out of sheer necessity, reasonably, well, I would hesitate to say humane, but reasonably non-painful, or little pain in it, little suffering. It's the humiliation, of course, comes into it, and simply fear of something you know perfectly well, the result. I mean, those waiting hours, I am sure that it was awful. See, I never was faced with such a situation. I was never in the position to be, so to speak, condemned to death, or being a part of the group which was condemned personally. I was taking the risk all the time. But that's a different thing. It's much easier. It's an individual risk. I can defend myself even in such a way that I can try to avoid to be kicked or beaten or something. I think the worst thing is if you could not do anything. You are one of the thousands standing and waiting until they kill you, like a cattle in the slaughterhouse. So you see, because of that, I am not a good witness here. I never experience this hopeless feeling of being destined to die.
Was there ever in your experience any resistance in camps, apart from things that you've already said, like writing poems was a form of resistance?
Yes, it was a sort of intellectual resistance. Well, yes, of course. I remember few cases. It was in Auschwitz when I think it was a separate, separate, not camp, but part of the camp was separated from the rest. And they were officers, only officers there. Prisons of war, but for some reason sent to the concentration camp. So probably they were selected for some reasons, maybe that they were opponents inside the prison of war camp, maybe that they were opponents against the rules of the camp. So for some reason or another, they were officers. And they rebel, and it was a successful rebel. They managed to break out, but I think practically almost without exception, all of them were cut later and taken back, and I think killed more or less instantly. So that's only one big rebellion which I remember. I've got now the date of this, but I remember all campus instantly informed what's going on. Well, another, but not think of that sort in Mauthausen-Gusen, not in my experience. I think one form of resistance, and very strong form of resistance, would be the sabotage in the factory. A lot was said about it. I read the book about it. I know even the author. He was working in Messerschmitt factory, and he claimed, together with his friends, on purpose, they making the mistake in production. And that was an important mistake because it would make shooting that methods of control, the direction of the fire in the aeroplane, make it wrong. Consequently, such an aeroplane would be not very useful on the battle. Well, you see, to be honest with you, I have some doubts about it. First of all, I would say that those aeroplanes would be 10 times tracked and tracked again. And I guess that any mistakes, any inaccuracies would be corrected. I would think so. I would be very surprised if it would be not the case. Second, if they would come to the action, if one would prove not very good, surely that they would ground it and check again and find out. And you see, then it would be very easy to find the point of production which make the mistake, and I'm sure they would react drastically. So I'm not quite sure if that would be the case. But it is another key thing. You can call it sabotage, you can call it differently. It happened to a friend of mine. You see, we're working producing the part of the machine gun, the camera when the ammunition comes into the into the place from where it's fired. Janusz was tired, sort of falling asleep, really, while working, while operating on this machine. And he produced 37 mistaken wrong parts. That was clearly dead for it. Definitely. It would be no excuse. They would kill him. And we have a colleague who was working together with us. Well, Janusz wake up, realize what he done. So it was a 50 pieces like that in the big wooden box. And we would, after finishing the box, we would push it to the next. It was chain production, 120 or 130 machines working. So we would put to the next position. So fortunately, before we pushed them there, I was standing next to him, you see. So the box arrived from his machine to mine. I was next one in the chain. And I realized that they are those mistakes. When I realize it, I wake him up. So we managed to hide them for a while. You see, it was quite a colossal production, so it was reasonably easy to hide them. I mean, another box would arrive. And we have the colleague who was thief. He actually even stole one cigarette from Janusz. But he proved to be a hero. Well, let's call him a hero. It was during the night. We're not allowed to leave the barrack, except to the toilet. So it was some movement between the barracks because people would go to the toilet, and it was only one toilet for whole block of. So some people would go, and the SS would not shoot to them if they would see nothing suspicious. You know, this young boy climbed through the window, take all those badly produced pieces, and between the two barracks, it was a heap of rubbish, metal. You know, metal used during the production. It was quite a lot of little bits of metal. He took those pieces, which Janusz make it accidentally useless, and hide them there. So he clearly saved his life. And he did not expect even gratitude. Oh, that's all right, you know. And he was professional thief. For that reason, he landed in the camp, not for political purposes. You see how difficult it is to judge morally people. It was just this petty criminal who saved life of his friend, of his colleague, first of all, 1 week or 2 weeks earlier, stealing 10 cigarettes from him. See, life in camp, it's full of that sort of accident. Suddenly, you learn one important thing. It's extremely difficult to judge human beings. One, I would try not to do it at all in my life if I if I can manage. Because it's in unexpected moments you realize how wrong you were. Usually we judge, well, we are lazy, most of us. Usually we judge according to the customs. We learn that stealing is a bad thing. So, of course, somebody who steals at least is a suspect. And, well, and this young lady which I was telling you about, she, surprisingly, proved herself to be very intelligent because she realized that the judging rashly actually took her to nowhere. And you see, that's why I think that she proved to be so much a human being. Her intelligence led her to be open for changing her own opinion. It's, I hope you would agree with me, the most difficult thing in life is to change your opinion when you come across the argument and document and whatever. It's simply because we don't like that. We don't like to be mistaken. We prefer to be honest always. Well, like God Almighty. You see, I learned early in my life. As a very young boy in school, in this Catholic school in Poland, I had a headmaster. He was not a headmaster. He was a chief educator. It was a different position of the headmaster and different of the... he was looking after us, and after our, not education, but our morals. And I didn't like him. Father Joseph, his name was, Father Joseph Jarembowski. And I was sent to him in the sort of unpleasant expedition because I, in a way, misbehaved in the class. And when I arrived there, I corrected the teacher. And teacher made a mistake. It was the mistake. And I was sent to Father Joseph. And Father Joseph liked me. So he said, sit down, boy. All right. Tell me how it was. So, of course, I tell the gospel true. I would never lie to Father Joseph, to anybody else, yes, but not to Father Joseph. He was my friend. And then we're alone in his cabinet. But he just checked if no secretaries are present. And he said, look, boy, if somebody believes that he never makes mistakes, he is God Almighty. But if by chance he's not God Almighty, he's an ass. And that was my teacher.